It took a court to force the state to recognize civil unions by discovering that right in the Vermont Constitution. Where's Osama? The big argument for civil unions, but not marriage, is that gays are denied ordinary civil rights here in the American Taliban. This is where gays usually bring up the argument about all the straight couples living in sham marriages, but I see no point in dragging the Clintons into this. The classic formulation was given by John Kerry in the Democratic debate earlier this week. What we're talking about is somebody's right to be able to visit a loved one in a hospital, somebody's right to be able to pass on property, somebody's right to live equally under the state laws as other people in the country. You would think there were straights-only water fountains the way Democrats carry on so, as if any gay man would drink non-bottled water. Apparently, healthcare in this country is better than we've been led to believe if so few Americans have ever been to a hospital that they think there's a guest list. In case you don't know, gays already can visit loved ones in hospitals. They can also visit neighbors, random acquaintances, and total strangers in hospitals, just like everyone else. Gays can also pass on property to whomever they would like, including their cats. Every few years, you read about some daft rich widow leaving her entire estate to a cat. It's perfectly legal, you just need to write a will. Liberals have figured out how to get abortions for 13-year-old girls across state lines without their parents' permission. But we're supposed to believe that they just can't get their heads around how a gay guy could leave property to his partner. As for living equally under the state laws as other people in the country, unless Kerry is referring to the precise thing he claims to oppose, gay marriage, gays do live equally under the state laws as other people in the country. There are no special speed limit laws or trespassing laws for gays. There is, however, some evidence of gay profiling with regard to the enforcement of fashion don'ts. What gays can't do is get married, something all Democrats swear up and down to oppose. Instead, the Democrats demand civil unions and then throw out a series of red herrings to explain why. In fact, the only difference between what the Democrats claim to support, civil unions, and what they claim to oppose, gay marriage, is the word marriage. As John Kerry explained, I think the term marriage gets in the way of what's really being talked about here. Republicans ought to try that. We don't support guns. The term gun gets in the way of what is really being talked about here. We want choice and personal security devices. We don't want a ban on partial birth abortions. We just don't want there to be any of them. We don't support tax cuts. We support a union between people and 70% of their money. We don't support war with Iraq. We are talking about somebody's right to be able to visit a loved one in a hospital, huh? Except the difference is, all those positions are popular with voters, so Republicans don't have to lie. The Democrats' purported opposition to gay marriage is like all their other phony policy statements that are the opposite of what they really believe. When they're running for office, all Democrats claim to support tax cuts for the middle class, to support gun rights for hunters, and to personally oppose abortion. And then they get into office and vote to raise taxes, ban guns, and allow abortions if a girl can't fit into her prom dress. The common wisdom holds that both parties have to appeal to the extremes during the primary and then move to the center for the general election. To the contrary, both parties run for office as conservatives. Once they have fooled the voters and are safely in office, Republicans sometimes double-cross the voters. Democrats always do.
The Passion of the Liberal, March 3, 2004.
In the dozens and dozens of panic-stricken articles the New York Times has run on Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, the unavoidable conclusion is that liberals haven't the vaguest idea what Christianity is. The Times may have loopy ideas about a lot of things, but at least when they write about gay bathhouses and abortion clinics, you get the sense that they know what they're talking about. But Christianity just doesn't ring a bell. The religion that has transformed Western civilization for two millennia is a blank slate for liberals. Their closest reference point is conservative Christians, meaning people you're not supposed to hire. And these are the people who carp about George Bush's alleged lack of intellectual curiosity. The most amazing complaint, championed by the Times and repeated by all the know-nothing secularists on television, is that Gibson insisted on rubbing our faces in the grisly reality of Jesus' death. The Times was irked that Gibson relentlessly focused on the savagery of Jesus' final hours, at the expense of showing us the happy Jesus. Yes, Gibson's movie is crying out for a car chase, a sex scene, or maybe a wisecracking orangutan. The Times ought to send one of its crack investigative reporters to St. Patrick's Cathedral at 3 p.m. on Good Friday before leaping to the conclusion that The Passion is Gibson's idiosyncratic take on Christianity. In a standard Sunday ritual, Christians routinely eat the flesh and drink the blood of Jesus Christ, a.k.a. the Lamb of God. The really serious Catholics do that blood and flesh-eating thing every day, the sickos. The Times has just discovered the tip of a 2,000-year-old iceberg. But the loony left is testy with Gibson for spending so much time on Jesus' suffering and death while giving short shrift to Jesus' ministry and ideas, as another Times reviewer put it. According to liberals, the message of Jesus, which somehow Gibson missed, is something along the lines of, be nice to people, which to them means raise taxes on the productive. You don't need a religion like Christianity, which is a rather large and complex endeavor, in order to flag that message. All you need is a moron driving around in a Volvo with a bumper sticker that says, be nice to people. Being nice to people is, in fact, one of the incidental tenets of Christianity, as opposed to other religions whose tenets are more along the lines of, kill everyone who doesn't smell bad or answer to the name Muhammad. But to call it the message of Jesus requires, well, the brain of Maureen Dowd. In fact, Jesus' distinctive message was, people are sinful and need to be redeemed, and this is your lucky day because I'm here to redeem you even though you don't deserve it, and I have to get the crap kicked out of me to do it. That's the reason he is called Christ the Redeemer, rather than Christ the moron driving around in a Volvo with a Be Nice to People bumper sticker on it. The other complaint from the know-nothing crowd is that the passion will inspire anti-Semitic violence. If nothing else comes out of this movie, at least we finally have liberals on record opposing anti-Semitic violence. Perhaps they should broach that topic with their Muslim friends. One Times review of The Passion said, to be a Christian is to face the responsibility for one's own most treasured sacred texts being used to justify the deaths of innocents. At best, this is like blaming Jodie Foster for the shooting of Ronald Reagan. But the reviewer somberly warned that a Christian should not take the risk that one's life or work might contribute to the continuation of a horror. So the only thing Christians can do is shut up about their religion. And no more Jodie Foster movies. By contrast, in the weeks after 9/11, the Times was rushing to assure its readers that prominent Islamic scholars and theologians in the West say unequivocally that nothing in Islam countenances the September 11th actions. That's if you set aside Muhammad's many specific instructions to kill non-believers whenever possible. Times columnists repeatedly extolled the great majority of peaceful Muslims. Only a religion with millions of practitioners trying to kill Americans and Jews is axiomatically described as peaceful by liberals. As I understand it, the dangerous religion is the one whose Messiah instructs, if one strikes thee on the right cheek, turn him the other also. And love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that persecute and calumniate you. The peaceful religion instructs, slay the enemy where you find him. Imitating the ostrich-like posture of certain German Jews who ignored the growing danger during Hitler's rise to power, today's liberals are deliberately blind to the real threats of violence that surround us. Their narcissistic self-image requires absolute solicitude toward angry savages plotting acts of terrorism. The only people who scare them are the ones who worship a Jew.
Great Gray Lady in Spat with Saloon Hussy, November 20, 2002.
I did not realize how devastating the midterm elections were to liberals until seeing the Great Gray Lady reduced to starting a catfight with Fox News Channel. It has come to this. The New York Times was in high dudgeon this week upon discovering that Fox News chairman Roger Ailes sent a letter to the Bush White House 9 days after September 11th. As the corpses of thousands of his fellow Americans lay in smoldering heaps, Ailes evidently recommended getting rough with the terrorists. One imagines Karl Rove running down the hallway to the president's office, waving Ailes' letter and shouting, Mr. President, Mr. President, I have the memo. We've got to fight back. I assume it's superfluous to mention that there is nothing illegal about Ailes giving advice to the president, though admittedly I have not consulted the living constitution in the past 24 hours to see if a new penumbra specifically about Fox News has sprouted. But the Times was a monument of self-righteous indignation, because hard newsmen are supposed to stay neutral between America and the terrorists. Of course, the Times hasn't been reticent about giving the president advice on the war. Surrender now! Other great moments in journalistic neutrality include NPR's Nina Totenberg leaking information about Anita Hill that she got from Senator Howard Metzenbaum's staff, and the Washington Post's Ben Bradley yucking it up on the phone with President Kennedy, and later cheering when President Nixon resigned. So it's interesting that the Times viewed Ailes' letter as an affront to objective journalism. But this was more than the media's usual insane point that they, the least impartial industry in America, must maintain absolute neutrality between George Bush and the terrorists. The Times went further to imply that, by supporting his own country in the war on terrorism, Ailes had unmistakably marked himself as a partisan conservative. If Ailes had written a letter recommending a tax hike, a new hate crimes law, or going easy on the terrorists, I assume the Times would not have accused Ailes of showing a conservative bias. Instead, he had recommended the harshest measures possible against the terrorists. As far as the Times was concerned, this was the smoking gun of partisanship. The paper railed that Ailes purports to be an unbiased journalist, not a conservative spokesman. Fox News is the self-proclaimed fair and balanced news channel. But now the Times had caught him red-handed, pursuing an undisguised ideological agenda. Ailes is secretly rooting for America. At least we finally have it from the horse's own mouth. The Times openly admits that the conservative position, but not the liberal position, is to take America's side against the terrorists. Why do they get so snippy when I say that? The Times was a whirligig of pointless insinuations, secretly gave advice to, back-channel message, shocking, confirmed yesterday, and revelations. Eager Times readers will have to wait another day for any revelations about Pinch Sulzberger's SAT scores. Belittling Fox News is so pleasurable for the Times that it didn't occur to them that they had given up the ghost on their faux patriotism. It is simply taken for granted that liberals root against their own country. As the Times said of Ailes' letter, it was less shocking than it was liberating. A little like the moment in 1985 when an ailing Rock Hudson finally explained that he had AIDS. Same back at you. We always knew you were traitors, and now you've admitted it. Fox News should agree to admit it is conservative if all other media outlets will admit they are liberal. Fox is manifestly closer to the center than the others. Referring here to the Times' definition of conservative, harsh with the terrorists, and liberal, soft on the terrorists, I believe the public is with Fox News. We took a pretty conclusive poll on that a couple of weeks ago. The people, in their infinite wisdom, have spoken.
How a white male from Alabama learned the craft of journalism from a young reporter named Jason Blair. May 14, 2003.
The New York Times is to be commended for ferreting out Jason Blair, the reporter recently discovered making up facts, plagiarizing other news organizations, and lying about non-existent trips and interviews. A newspaper that employs Maureen Dowd can't have had an easy time settling on Blair as the scapegoat. Blair's record of inaccuracies, lies, and distortions made him a candidate for either immediate dismissal or his own regular column on the op-ed page. The editors have set up a special email address for readers to report falsehoods they discover in Jason Blair articles. Okay, but how about setting up one for Paul Krugman? The Times ought to seize the moment and claim all those front-page articles predicting a quagmire in Iraq were also written by Blair. The Times has now willingly abandoned its mantle as the newspaper of record. It was already up against the Internet and LexisNexis as a research tool, but with Jason Blair it has managed to leapfrog beyond mere technological obsolescence. All the Times had left was its reputation for accuracy. As this episode shows, the Times is not even attempting to preserve a reliable record of events. Instead of being a record of history, the Times is merely a record of what liberals would like history to be. The Pentagon in crisis, a quagmire in Iraq, global warming is melting the North Pole, protests roiled the Augusta National Golf Club. Publisher Arthur Pinch Sulzberger has turned the paper into a sort of bulletin board for Manhattan liberals. In the Soviet-style reporting preferred at the Times, its self-investigation of the Blair scandal included copious denials that race had anything to do with it. Mr. Boyd said last week that the decision to advance Mr. Blair had not been based on race. Mr. Blair's Times supervisors emphasized that he earned an internship at the Times because of glowing recommendations and a remarkable work history, not because he is black. Did Jason Blair write the article on the investigation of Jason Blair? The very next sentence notes that the Times offered Blair a slot in an internship program that was then being used in large part to help the paper diversify its newsroom. If the Times diversity program did not consider Blair's race, then it wasn't much of a diversity program, now was it? This is like job advertisements that proclaim equal opportunity affirmative action employer. Well, which is it? In one of several feverish editorials supporting the University of Michigan's race-based admissions program, the Times denounced the Bush administration for imagining that diversity can be achieved without explicitly taking race into account. Any diversity program that failed to do so, the Times lectured, was necessarily flawed. But then it gets caught publishing Jason Blair, and the Times demurely insists that its own affirmative action program scrupulously ignored race. Oh, okay. The Times not only expressly took race into account, but also put Blair's race above everything. Accuracy, credibility, and the paper's reputation. It hired a kid barely out of college. In fact, it turns out Blair was not yet out of college. He had no professional journalistic experience except at the Times. He screwed up over and over again, and the paper had to print 50 corrections to articles he'd written. Despite all this, Blair was repeatedly published on the front page, promoted, and sent love notes from the editor-in-chief, Howell Raines. Ignoring the warnings of a few intrepid whistleblowers, top management kept assigning Blair to bigger stories in new departments without alerting the editors to Blair's history, because, as Raines said, it would stigmatize him. Speaking of stigmas, after this scandal, does the demand for black heart surgeons go up or down? Raines jettisoned the Times' famous slogan, "All the news that's fit to print," preferring the slogan, "The New York Times, now with even more black people." Publisher Sulzberger summed up the episode with these words, "The person who did this is Jason Blair. Let's not begin to demonize our executives. To put that in plain English, even though we hired him, we promoted him, and we covered up for him, and even though it's our name on the masthead, we assume absolutely no responsibility for any of this whatsoever. If mismanagement at Enron had been this clear-cut, the Times would be demanding the death penalty for Ken Lay. Indeed, taking a page from all corporate chieftains caught in scandals, the Times insists that the organization is fine, it was just one bad apple. As I recall, the Times editorial page did not accept that explanation when Merrill Lynch said it about Henry Blodgett. Raines' behavior is far worse than the corporate chieftains. He clearly bears the most responsibility for this fiasco, but when disaster strikes, he blames the black kid. So far, Raines' response has been basically to say, you try to help these people. Raines' other great contribution to race relations was his unintentionally comical magazine piece about his black maid, Grady's Gift. It's absolutely Clintonian. Just as Clinton blamed that woman and said anyone who blamed him was probably a Christian fundamentalist and a menace to a woman's right to choose, Raines is setting up the defense that his detractors must be bigots opposed to affirmative action. You posture, champion this righteous cause and that righteous cause, abuse your responsibility, and when you get in trouble, you blame that woman. Put aside whether race should be used as a hiring criterion, even people who support affirmative action don't have to support Raines' approach of refusing to hold blacks responsible for anything ever, including fake reporting. What Raines did to Blair was cruel. Think of it in a non-racial context. Suppose the owner of a big company sends his kid to learn the business and tells low-level managers to treat him just as they would treat anyone else. The managers try to curry favor with the boss by reporting that his son is doing great and is a natural genius for this business. So the kid keeps getting praised and promoted until one day he's actually put in charge of something he has no ability to run. That is cruel. And it's the story of Pinch Sulzberger, isn't it?
Cleland drops a political grenade. February 11, 2004.
Former Senator Max Cleland is the Democrats' designated hysteric about George Bush's National Guard service. A triple amputee and Vietnam veteran, Cleland is making the rounds on talk TV, basking in the affection of liberals who have suddenly become jock sniffers for war veterans, and working himself into a lather about George Bush's military service. Citing such renowned military experts as Molly Ivins, Cleland indignantly demands further investigation into Bush's service with the Texas Air National Guard. Bush's National Guard service is the most thoroughly investigated event since the Kennedy assassination. But Democrats will accept only two possible conclusions to their baseless accusations. One, Bush was AWOL, or two, the matter needs further investigation. 30 years ago, Bush was granted an honorable discharge from the National Guard, which would seem to put the matter to rest. But liberals want proof that Bush actually deserved his honorable discharge. Since when did the party of Bill Clinton, Teddy Kennedy, and Robert Byrd get so obsessed with honor? On Hardball Monday night, Cleland demanded to see Bush's pay stubs for the disputed period of time, May 1972 to May 1973. If he was getting paid for his weekend warrior work, Cleland said, he should have some pay stubs to show it. The next day, the White House produced the pay stubs. This confirmed what has been confirmed 1 million times before. After taking the summer off, Bush reported for duty 9 times between November 29, 1972 and May 24, 1973, more than enough times to fulfill his guard duties, and 9 times more than Bill Clinton, Barney Frank, or Chuck Schumer did during the same period. All this has been reported, with documentation, many times by many news organizations. George Magazine had Bush's National Guard records 3.5 years ago. All available evidence keeps confirming Bush's honorable service with the Guard, which leads liberals to conclude further investigation is needed. No evidence will ever be enough evidence. That Bush skipped out on his National Guard service is one of liberals' many non-disprovable beliefs, like global warming. Cleland also expressed outrage that Bush left the National Guard 9 months early in 1973 to go to Harvard Business School. On Hardball, Cleland testily remarked, "I just know a whole lot of veterans who would have loved to have worked things out with the military and adjusted their tour of duty." Cleland already knows one who did, Al Gore. When Bush left the National Guard in 1973 to go to business school, the war was over. It might as well have been 1986. Presidents Kennedy and Johnson had already lost the war, and President Nixon had ended it with the Paris Peace Accords in January. If Bush had demanded active combat, there would have been no war to send him to. To put this in perspective, by 1973, John Kerry had already accused American soldiers of committing war crimes in Vietnam, thrown someone else's medals to the ground in an anti-war demonstration, and married his first heiress. Bill Clinton had just finished 3 years of law school and was about to embark upon a political career, which would include campaign events with Max Cleland. Moreover, if we're going to start delving into exactly who did what back then, maybe Max Cleland should stop allowing Democrats to portray him as a war hero who lost his limbs taking enemy fire on the battlefields of Vietnam. Cleland lost three limbs in an accident during a routine non-combat mission where he was about to drink beer with friends. He saw a grenade on the ground and picked it up. He could have done that at Fort Dix. In fact, Cleland could have dropped a grenade on his foot as a National Guardsman, what Cleland sneeringly calls weekend warriors. Luckily for Cleland's political career and current pomposity about Bush, he happened to do it while he was in Vietnam. There is more than a whiff of dishonesty in how Cleland is presented to the American people. Terry McAuliffe goes around saying, "Max Cleland, a triple amputee who left three limbs on the battlefield of Vietnam, was thrown out of office because Republicans had the audacity to call Max Cleland unpatriotic." Mr. Cleland, a word of advice. When a slimy weasel like Terry McAuliffe is vouching for your combat record, it's time to sound retreat on that subject. Needless to say, no one ever challenged Cleland's patriotism. His performance in the Senate was the issue, which should not have come as a bolt out of the blue in as much as he was running for re-election to the Senate. Senator Cleland had refused to vote for the Homeland Security bill unless it was chock-full of pro-union perks that would have jeopardized national security. "Oh my God, a hijacked plane is headed for the White House. Sorry, I'm on my break. Please call back in 2 hours. The good people of Georgia, who do not need lectures on admiring military service, gave Cleland one pass for being a Vietnam veteran. He didn't get a lifetime pass. Indeed, if Cleland had dropped a grenade on himself at Fort Dix rather than in Vietnam, he would never have been a U.S. senator in the first place. Maybe he'd be the best pharmacist in Atlanta, but not a U.S. senator. He got into office on the basis of serving in Vietnam and was thrown out for his performance as a senator. Cleland wore the uniform, he was in Vietnam, and he has shown courage by going on to lead a productive life. But he didn't give his limbs for his country or leave them on the battlefield. There was no bravery involved in dropping a grenade on himself with no enemy troops in sight. That could have happened in the Texas National Guard, which Cleland denigrates while demanding his own sanctification.
File under Omission Accomplished, February 19, 2004.
Liberals are hopping mad about last week's column. Amid angry insinuations that I lied about Senator Max Cleland, I was attacked on the Senate floor by Senator Jack Reed. Molly Ivins called my column error-ridden, and Al Hunt called it a lie. Joe Klein said I was the reason liberals were being hysterical about George Bush's National Guard service. No wonder liberals can't win politically if little scrawny me gets them so upset. I would have left it at one column, but apparently Democrats want to go another round. With their Clinton-esque formulations, my detractors make it a little difficult to know what lie I'm supposed to be contesting, but they are clearly implying, without stating, that Cleland lost his limbs in combat. It is simply a fact that Max Cleland was not injured by enemy fire in Vietnam. He was not in combat, he was not, as Al Hunt claimed, on a reconnaissance mission, and he was not in the Battle of Khe Sanh, as many others have implied. He picked up an American grenade on a routine non-combat mission, and the grenade exploded. In Cleland's own words, "I didn't see any heroism in all that. It wasn't an act of heroism. I didn't know the grenade was live. It was an act of fate." That is why Cleland didn't win a Purple Heart, which is given to those wounded in combat. Liberals aren't angry because I lied. They're angry because I told the truth. I wouldn't press the point, except the Democrats have deliberately sexed up the circumstances of Cleland's accident in the service of slandering the people of Georgia, the National Guard, and George Bush. Cleland has questioned Bush's fitness for office because he served in the National Guard and was not sent to Vietnam. and yet the poignant truth of Cleland's own accident demonstrates the commitment and bravery of all members of the military who come into contact with ordnance. Cleland's injury was of the routine variety that occurs whenever young men and weapons are put in close proximity, including in the National Guard. But it is a vastly more glorious story to claim that Cleland was injured by enemy fire rather than in a freak accident. So after Saxby Chambliss beat Cleland in the 2002 Georgia Senate race, liberals set to work developing a carefully crafted myth about Cleland's accident. Among many other examples, last November, Eric Bollert wrote in Salon, "During the siege of Khe Sanh, Cleland lost both his legs and his right hand to a Viet Cong grenade." Sadly for them, dozens and dozens of newspapers had already printed the truth. Liberals simply can't grasp the problem LexisNexis poses to their incessant lying. They ought to stick to their specialty, hysterical overreaction. The truth is not their forte. One of the most detailed accounts of Cleland's life was written by Jill Zuckman in a long piece for the Boston Globe magazine on August 3, 1997. Finally, the battle at Khe Sanh was over. Cleland, 25 years old, and two members of his team were now ordered to set up a radio relay station at the division assembly area, 15 miles away. The three gathered antennas, radios, and a generator, and made the 15-minute helicopter trip east. After unloading the equipment, Cleland climbs back into the helicopter for the ride back. But at the last minute, he decided to stay and have a beer with some friends. As the helicopter was lifting off, he shouted to the pilot that he was staying behind and jumped several feet to the ground. Cleland hunched over to avoid the whirring blades and ran. Turning to face the helicopter, he caught sight of a grenade on the ground where the chopper had perched. "It must be mine," he thought, moving toward it. He reached for it with his right arm just as it exploded, slamming him back and irreparably altering his plans for a bright, shining future. Interestingly, all news accounts told the exact same story for 30 years, including that Cleland had stopped to have beer with friends when the accident occurred, a fact that particularly irked Al Hunt. From the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, "He told the pilot he was going to stay a while, maybe have a few beers with friends. Then Cleland looked down and saw a grenade. Where'd that come from? He walked toward it, bent down, and crossed the line between before and after." From the Baltimore Sun, "Cleland didn't step on a landmine. He wasn't wounded in a firefight. He couldn't blame the Viet Cong or friendly fire. The Silver Star and Bronze Star medals he received only embarrassed him. He was no hero. He blew himself up." From the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, "Cleland was no war hero, but his sacrifice was great. Democratic Senate candidate Max Cleland is a victim of war, not a casualty of combat. He lost three limbs on a long-forgotten hill near Khe Sanh because of some American's mistake." The story only started to change last year when the Democrats began citing Cleland's lost Senate seat as proof that Republicans hate war heroes. Indeed, until the myth of Republicans attacking Cleland for his lack of patriotism became central to the Democrats' narrative against George Bush, Cleland spoke only honorably and humbly about his accident. "How did I become a war hero?" he said to the Boston Globe reporter in 1997. "Simple. The grenade went off." Cleland even admitted that but for his accident, he would probably have been some frustrated history teacher teaching American government at some junior college. Okay, I got that wrong. In my column, I said he'd probably be a pharmacist. Cleland's true heroism came after the war, when he went on to build a productive life for himself. That is a story of inspiration and courage. He shouldn't let the Democrats tarnish an admirable life by sexing up his record in order to better attack George Bush.
My readers respond. Email exchange with Time Magazine.
Friday, February 20th, 2004. "Anne, I'm a correspondent in Time's Washington Bureau. I'm interested in the back and forth over the military service of President Bush and former Senator Max Cleland." Eric Roston, Time Magazine. Question: why write a second column about Cleland? Answer: liberals were lying, which isn't new, but the facts were indisputable, and it's always fun pointing out when liberals are lying. Question: what role could the veteran vote play in November? Answer: I am sublimely confident that most military types will vote for Bush. Question: traditionally, Republicans have been popularly thought to be the party for veterans, not Democrats. If Senator Kerry becomes the Democratic nominee, could that confuse these traditional categories? Answer: no. Question: what is a good definition of combat mission and battlefield? Is it useful to draw a distinction between combat and combat zone? 4 days before then-Captain Cleland's accident, four soldiers were killed near that spot by enemy mortar. Would you characterize it then as occurring in a combat zone? Answer: the Purple Heart Committee seems to have figured it out. You may take up your quarrel with them. Question. The validity of your arguments appears to hinge on how you define these words. How do you explain the discrepancy of what appears to be very technical usages of combat and battlefield and what appear to be non-technical uses of words such as treason and slander? Answer. A. Again, you may pursue your argument with the people who award Purple Hearts, but whatever else it means, I believe the technical definition of combat would include a time and place when you are not about to have beer with your friends. B. I do use treason and slander technically. I simply apply the terms to liberals as a group, not a single individual. Question. You write, Cleland could have dropped a grenade on his foot as a National Guardsman. The grenade was said to be dropped by the soldier behind Cleland. The problem, according to people on the scene, was that this soldier had been straightening the pins on his grenades for easier access during enemy fire. Since that would not likely have been the case at Fort Dix, do you still stand by that notion? Answer. Look up the meaning of ordnance. As I said in my column, whenever young men and ordnance are put together, there are a staggering number of casualties, which is why military training and discipline are so important. I would hazard a guess that more pilots are killed in National Guard flight training than servicemen are killed by negligently picking up grenades. Perhaps you could put one of your crack investigators on this. Question. People familiar with Cleland's experience say that he requested to be moved from a desk job in Saigon to a place closer to the action. Then from there he requested to become active in Khe Sanh. Do you believe this to be accurate? If so, does it affect your argument? Answer. It has absolutely nothing to do with my argument. I hear he's also nice to his mother. If I ever write about how Cleland treats his mother or write a review of his entire military career, I'll be sure to mention both. I simply accuse snivelers like you, who in the blink of an eye have gone from being army haters to jock sniffers for war veterans, of sexing up Cleland's accident. Question. Approximately one-third of U.S. casualties in Vietnam were caused by some sort of friendly fire or accident. Following your logic, does that mean that none of these soldiers died or were wounded for their country? Answer. No, to the contrary. They all died for their country, but they did not die in combat. Dishonest reporters like you apparently think that's not good enough and have insisted on suggesting that Cleland lost his limbs in combat. Question. You appear to belittle then-Captain Cleland for being willing to drink a beer under non-combat conditions. Given an opportunity to drink a beer over a hill from the Battle of Khe Sanh, would you do so? Answer. A. I'm not belittling it at all, but I'm glad you're finally willing to concede it was non-combat. B. It is so breathtakingly stupid to claim I was belittling Cleland for being willing to drink a beer under non-combat conditions that I question your ability to comprehend anything you read. C. Yes, I might, but if I then stepped on a grenade, I would not accept canonization from the likes of you or believe that it entitled me to a job for life in the U.S. Senate. Tuesday, February 24, 2004. Anne, thanks for your help last week. The story was held for space. Eric Rosten, Time Magazine.
The New York Times goes wilding on the Central Park jogger. October 16, 2002.
Probably feeling humiliated, in 1989, a mob of feral beasts descended on Central Park to attack joggers and bicyclists. They brutalized a female jogger while incomprehensibly chanting "Wild Thing" in their ghetto patois. The jogger, a 110-pound white female investment banker, was beaten so badly she was declared dead on arrival at the hospital. Her skull was crushed and she had lost two-thirds of her blood. Her attacker spent the night in jail joking about the attack, singing a rap song, and whistling at policewomen. In his written confession, Yusuf Salam said, "It was fun." At the onset of the first Central Park rape trial, The New American, a black newspaper in New York City, ran a front-page headline about the jogger titled, "The Truth About the Whore." Or as the New York Times described the headline, it employed a sexual epithet. The article spun out the theory that her boyfriend had attacked her. The editor acknowledged that the article was not based on any specific evidence. "That's why it's called a theory," he said. "A theory means no evidence." Recently, the media have been spinning out their own theories about the attack, using the precise same definition of theory. The newsflash being billboarded across every New York news outlet right now is that prison inmate Matias Reyes has confessed to being the jogger's sole attacker. Breathless news accounts claim that the police were shocked to discover that new DNA testing has now proved Reyes alone attacked the jogger, and that the others did not. This is a lie. Liberals so long to claim that every criminal is innocent, they forget that the Central Park rape case received a lot of media attention when it happened, so they can't lie and scream about another phony DNA exoneration this time. The facts are easily accessible on LexisNexis. In fact, it was undisputed that the semen found on the jogger did not match any of the defendants. Headlines at the time proclaimed, Semen tested in jogger case was not that of defendants, New York Times. Semen suspects no match, says DNA expert in jog case, Newsday. DNA expert, no semen links to defendants, Associated Press. And experts say semen on jogger is not teens, The Record. Whatever evidence convinced two juries to convict the five animals, it was not DNA evidence. As usual, the media simply waited a decade, and then rushed to print with the same arguments used by the defense at the time, and claimed it was new evidence. This is standard operating procedure in exonerating convicted criminals. In a stunningly dishonest article, the New York Times states that the results from a battery of new DNA tests, which show that Mr. Reyes raped the jogger, have all been consistent with his version of events. The new DNA tests are consistent with precisely one part of Reyes's story. Matias Reyes raped the Central Park jogger. This is not new information. It was always known that a sixth rapist was out there. The police just didn't know who he was. In her summation to the jury, prosecutor Elizabeth Lederer told the jurors, others who were not caught raped her and got away. Consequently, the new DNA tests are also consistent with the version of events presented in court, subjected to attack by defense counsel, and believed unanimously by two multiracial juries. The five primitives on trial were described as among those who attacked the jogger. No new evidence contradicts those five guilty verdicts. Knowing that a sixth rapist had gotten away, the jury still convicted the five who were caught. The evidence that convinced the two juries to convict the savages was primarily their videotaped confessions. There was other evidence, such as one defendant's undershorts full of semen, dirt, grass, and other debris. According to accounts of their deliberations, one juror held up the undershorts and said, "How do you think they got this way?" The 10 videotape statements were made in the presence of the suspect's parents, provided graphic details about the attack, were tested in court, and were believed by unanimous juries. Antron McRae's videotaped confession included this: "We charged her, and we got her on the ground. Everybody started hitting her and stuff. She was on the ground, everybody stomping and everything. I grabbed one arm, some other kid grabbed one arm, and we grabbed her legs and stuff. Then we all took turns getting on top of her." Now these confessions are supposed to be trumped by the untested, unchallenged jailhouse confession of a murderer and serial rapist who claims he acted alone. At trial, the defense was that the boys had lied in their confessions. The defendant's lawyers vigorously attacked the confessions, leaping in to highlight any inconsistencies or exculpatory facts now being treated as new evidence by the New York Times. Antron's father told the jury that he had instructed his son to lie to the police and tell them he raped the girl so the police would let him go. This is often what happens when you tell the police in graphic and gruesome detail how you gang-raped a woman. The police let you go. With arguments like that, Antron's father could soon be giving legal commentary on the Record with Greta Van Susteren. The jurors evaluated the credibility of the stories and the witnesses. They observed the demeanor of the defendants, the police, and other witnesses. After carefully weighing all the evidence, the jurors decided the defendants were guilty. The public got a glimpse of what jurors saw when Yusuf Salam was interviewed by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes in 1992. Salam said he suspected the jogger, the one declared DOA at the hospital, was faking. He also said that even though he had lied in his confession, people should believe he was telling the truth about the confession being a lie because he was a Muslim. "That's all a Muslim has," he said, explaining why he lied, "his word." That may be good enough for the New York Times, but apparently it wasn't good enough for the jury. Providentially, our criminal justice system presupposes that juries are better positioned to evaluate the truth than New York Times reporters looking for the next Scottsboro Boys case. Two juries already heard all the arguments now being reported as shocking new evidence, and unanimously disbelieved the defendants. This isn't the latest Scottsboro Boys case. It's the latest Tawana Brawley case.
At least with Monica, he only bit his own lip. March 6, 1999.
Well, we got another first last week. In the Barbara Walters interview, Monica Lewinsky affirmed, happily, giddily, that Clinton did things to her that made her feel as a woman, happy and contented. Now, I can't remember back to the Nixon era, but I'm pretty sure Clinton just became the first president to have his capacity to induce orgasm described on national TV. He can add this to his growing list of firsts, including first president accused of rape within 2 weeks after being acquitted in an impeachment trial. Monica admitted that she was an emotional wreck over her affair with the president, whining to anyone who would listen and throwing fits at the White House Westgate. She said she does not have the self-worth a woman should have. During her 10-month banishment from the White House, she consoled herself with a sexual relationship with a man at the Pentagon, a certain Thomas, which led to a pregnancy and an abortion. I wondered how Thomas was enjoying the interview. She described the thong-flashing incident as a subtle flirtation. She admitted that she's had affairs with other married men, that she was in therapy, that she's contemplated suicide, and that she was currently on antidepressants. Barbara Walters should have taken Monica's deposition for the Senate trial, especially if the lusty little tart promised to load up on the Prozac again. At least Monica seems to have overcome that self-worth problem. Instead of wanting to crawl into a hole the way a normal person might, Monica seemed to think she was Gwyneth Paltrow promoting a new blockbuster movie. Though Clinton didn't know Monica's name until the third time she showed up to earn her presidential knee pads, having to swat away half the National Press Corps to get there, Monica earnestly told her interlocutor she thought Clinton loved her. He never actually said he loved her, though he did tell her, "You look skinny." In response to her profession of love, he said, "That means a lot to me." Many people would have taken that as a hint. But Monica thought he loved her by the way he looked at me. What really sold Monica on the idea that Bill, these allegations are false, Clinton, loved her, was the now famous gift, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. That, she told Walters, is the sort of gift you wouldn't give someone that you didn't hold in a certain place in your heart. Except that Clinton apparently had a closet full of them. The Leaves of Grass gift was reputedly the detail that finally sent Hillary over the edge. It was the first gift he gave her, too. There are probably a lot of copies floating around out there. The very first time Monica earned her presidential knee pads, Clinton was, one, on the telephone, and, two, didn't know her name. They had their first substantive discussion, defined loosely, after their sixth sexual encounter. Porno movies have more intriguing plot lines and a lot more dialogue than what she terms her relationship with the president. But Monica assured viewers that Clinton did not see her as his sex object. Why? Because, Bill, these allegations are false. Monica, you look skinny today. I was never alone in a hotel with Paula Jones. I promise a middle-class tax cut. I will pull American troops out of Bosnia in 1 year. Clinton said so. He even started to tear up when the astute young Monica complained of feeling like his sex object. Monica began her description of the crying episode by saying, "You'll probably find it hard to believe." Not that hard, actually. At least with Monica, he only bit his own lip. Everyone makes fun of Linda Tripp for saying, "I am you," but far more disconcerting was Monica's smug assumption of what a sympathetic figure she cut. Whenever I hear about Monica's fabulous wit, intelligence, and personality, I wonder, who's not witty, intelligent, and charming? I just want to know for purposes of comparison. Consider that Monica's answer to the question of whether she thought the president was genuinely remorseful or just sorry he got caught was a real cliffhanger. She did get it right. I'm not sure what I would have done if I had been in Linda Tripp's untenable position, though I think I would have airdropped the tapes across America. The only person whose reaction was without precedent in the animal kingdom was Monica's father, Dr. Bernard Lewinsky. Upon discovering the married president had been using his half-wit daughter for sex games, Dr. Lewinsky decided to earn his own presidential knee pads. Monica explained her father's psychotic reaction by saying it was hard for him to express his anger when the guy who hurt his baby is the president of the United States. Yes, Dr. Lewinsky did have a little trouble expressing that thought. Some might say he sent a mixed message when he gushed to Katie Couric on the Today Show. "I respect President Clinton," and remarked that he and the president had something in common, two young daughters that are intelligent. By contrast, Dr. Lewinsky venomously attacked independent counsel Ken Starr, who only asked Monica questions, for persecuting my daughter with McCarthyism tactics, grip torture technique. As Monica snippily said of Linda Tripp, "I pity her. I wouldn't want to be her."
Hillary, Pro Dung, October 5, 1999.
Hillary's presumed Senate campaign is off to a smashing start. She has now established herself four-square pro-dung. Dung on the Virgin Mary. Dung and graphic pornographic pictures on the Virgin Mary. Mayor Rudy Giuliani must have thought he'd died and gone to heaven when this feminist cornpone decided to throw her hat into the ring. It took Giuliani about 30 seconds to flush out Hillary on the dung issue. About a week ago, New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani proposed that the Brooklyn Museum of Art stop using taxpayer money to fund attacks on religion. As he put it, "Hard-earned public tax dollars should not be used for what I consider to be, and I think many people in the city, a desecration of religion, and then also some other very, very sick things. The animals, the pedophiles. So don't use public tax dollars." The exhibit, titled Sensation, includes, among other works, animals submerged in formaldehyde, maggots eating an ox's head, and, most notoriously, a picture of the Virgin Mary with elephant dung and pornographic pictures affixed thereto. Hillary attacked the mayor, saying, "Our feelings of being offended should not lead to the penalizing and shutting down of an entire museum." Well, for one thing, she's not all that offended. Liberals are only offended by religious symbols that are displayed respectfully, caterwauling about the non-existent separation of church and state they claim is in the Constitution. But publicly funded attacks on religion they like. You can't tolerate the things you like. As Joe Sobrin has remarked, this is like saying the Pope tolerates Catholics. Free speech that liberals don't like is labeled hate speech and banned. But moreover, the mayor was not trying to shut down any museum. On Hillary's theory, the government is guilty of censoring anything it doesn't subsidize. Based on this conception of free speech, I feel the cruel lash of government censorship when the government doesn't pay me to write this column. As Giuliani said, just use your own money. One only has to read the press's straight-faced descriptions of the exhibit to see what a political home run the pro-dung stance was for Hillary. On Friday, October 1st, the New York Times ran a front-page photo of one of the exhibits, dryly reporting, "A shark in a tank of formaldehyde drew positive responses, but some thought a cut-up cow did not work as well." The Associated Press reported that at a shishi private showing of the exhibit, several attendees said they enjoyed the show, particularly a controversial dung-decorated Madonna. Commenting on the Holy Virgin Mary, a painting of a black Madonna with elephant dung on one breast and cutouts of genitalia from pornographic magazines in the background, one art lover explained, "Dung is considered a respectful symbol." Museum director Arnold Lehman, no stranger to dung himself, said of the dung-covered Madonna and other charming exhibits, "What they tell us is not a statement of blasphemy, but of reverence, but in a language that may be foreign to many of us. If people do not make the effort to understand, if people do not exercise tolerance and mutual respect, then we all suffer." That statement itself is a work of art. I paid a little field trip to the Brooklyn Museum to see Sensation, and this is what it made me think. I'd say the Elephant Man's oeuvre is a piece of but that would be a really bad pun. I wouldn't have even noticed it if I hadn't been guided by the audio tour, which, by the way, was the single most creative part of the exhibit. Until going to the Sensation exhibit, I did not know it was possible to use the words ironic and whimsical 5,000 times in 30 minutes. I just couldn't figure out why the audio tour guide sounded like a very pompous Michael Caine. I was in Brooklyn. Why not Brooklyn accents? That would have been much more appropriate, to say nothing of ironic and whimsical. The famous Madonna is barely recognizable as a depiction of a woman. If the Elephant Man hadn't managed to get the nose between the eyes, I wouldn't have known it was a human. The female genitalia pasted to the picture were, however, very true to life, which is not surprising inasmuch as they were actual cutouts from pornographic magazines. Very deep, even ironic and whimsical, I would say. The artist has said that his use of elephant dung, which he gets from the zoo, is intended to reflect African culture. Haven't the poor people of Africa suffered enough without some phony artiste using elephant dung to symbolize Africa? One collector defended the Elephant Man's use of the dung, saying it took some work to air out the rancid odor, but it was worth it because the artist was simply trying to make you think. The exhibit did not provoke shock, vomiting, confusion, panic, euphoria, and anxiety, as the much ballyhooed signs at the exhibit entry had warned, or let's just say, not nearly as much as the subway ride to the exhibit did. There was a lot of gross pornographic stuff, centering mainly on the pedophilic. If Hustler magazine editor, come Clinton aide, Larry Flint, could make a buck appealing to the prurient interests of pedophiles, this would be the official Hustler Museum. One artist, or combination of artists, had the ironic and whimsical idea of taking department store dummies of little girls and redesigning them, this is where the artistic talent comes in, so that some of their noses were penises, mouths were anuses or vaginas, and their little bodies were fused together in various bizarre Siamese twin fashions. In one of several such exhibits, the little girls' bodies were fused in ways that looked as though they were engaged in various forms of non-Euclidean sex. It was a statement about society. I'll grant them that it did make me think. I kept thinking, what commonplace couldn't be touted as a statement about our society? I am chewing gummy bears. In masticating the diminutive and brightly colored creature constructs, imagine Michael Caine saying this on the audio, and transforming them into new paradigms resembling wads of chewed up gum, I am making a statement about the kind of society that would eat cute little bears. The pretentious audio tour described a refrigerated bust made out of the artist's own blood, which was not even sculpted, just poured into a cast, as a statement about life itself. When the blood is inside us, you see, we think of it as part of us, but when the blood is outside our bodies, it's something outside of us. Just like toenail clippings. I didn't take notes, but I swear that is an accurate rendering of the meaning of the blood bust. Except the toenail clippings point, which was my own artistic addition. Also ironic and whimsical is the fact that if the refrigeration is turned off, the blood bust would melt to liquid. This shows the transitory nature of our essential beings, or that solids can melt to liquid if you turn off the refrigerator. I think it may also have said something about society, or maybe it was life, or death, or sex. On a few occasions, the audio tour indicated that such and such an artist had been rejected from various art schools before having the grand vision to put a bunch of poor dumb animals in formaldehyde. The audio guide seemed unaware that this sort of datum is interesting only if the art school reject turns out to be a brilliant artist. But it wasn't really that ironic here. I think the art schools were on to something. The director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Philippe de Montebello, no slouch in these matters, wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about the sensation exhibit, remarking that these artists deserve to remain obscure or be forgotten. The only actual art in the exhibit consisted of four large paintings of horses. Oddly enough, they were identifiable as horses, which is so unlike modern art. After having come up with words to describe a 6x6-foot painting that was entirely red, titled Raspberry, the audio tour guide was absolutely garrulous in describing paintings that actually looked like something. But the horse paintings would have felt neglected if the guide didn't say something idiotic about them, too. The horses, it seems, belong to the artist, who lives in England. And in England, there's a lot of racism and sexism. The tape tour really did say that. Back in New York City, where there's a lot of asininism, the media are in high dudgeon about Mayor Giuliani's decision not to bilk the taxpayers for this preposterous exhibit. In a phony poll taken by the New York Daily News, respondents were asked this completely ridiculous question. The Brooklyn Museum of Art is planning a show that includes a controversial portrait of the Virgin Mary that Mayor Giuliani finds offensive. The mayor wants to withdraw city funding for the museum if it goes through with the show. The museum says withdrawing city funds would violate the museum's First Amendment right to exhibit works of art it finds appropriate. Whose position do you agree with more? Needless to say, only 30% agreed that the mayor ought to be able to distribute public funds on the basis of his personal reaction to an art exhibit. 60% agreed more with the museum. Not to belabor the obvious, but the issue is not whether Mayor Giuliani personally finds the art offensive. Is that the taxpayers are being forced to subsidize alleged art that consists of, for example, the Holy Virgin Mary covered in vaginas and cow dung. But in Manhattan's elite salons, it is received wisdom that Giuliani's decision to cut the Brooklyn Museum's public funds is going to kill him politically. Indeed, when Giuliani showed up for opening night at the Metropolitan Opera House recently, he was greeted with a round of boos from the society crowd. At least when I'm out of touch with the average American, I know it. Not to put too fine a point on it, but opera fans aren't numerous enough to sustain the opera. They're not going to make or break a Senate campaign. Indeed, opera buffs are so expendable that they are regularly dismissed with derision by populist politicians in debates over government-sponsored art. In case you were wondering, Congress got into the business of shearing taxpayers for art pursuant to the Provide Funds for Chocolate-Covered Women provision of Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. During a Senate hearing on the National Endowment of the Arts back when I was working in the Senate, one of the Republican senators actually began denouncing the NEA for subsidizing opera tickets for the rich, rather than bringing art to the poor and disadvantaged, or some such cant. When did our guys start getting weepy about the poor? Republicans should go back to being crusty old men complaining about high taxes. For a brief fleeting moment, I supported the NEA. I figured at least the rich are getting some of their tax money back. But my reverie is unimportant. The point is, no politician has ever been hurt by ticking off opera lovers. Still, the New York Times quoted a couple of experts confidently asserting that Giuliani's battle with the museum would hurt him with voters. Mitchell L. Moss, director of the Taub Urban Research Center at New York University, said, "Giuliani is going to lose some of the Democrats who otherwise might have voted for him." Lee M. Meringoff, director of the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion, concurred, saying that Giuliani's position is going to turn off the people who were neutral on Rudy, who were kind of the moderate types. Admittedly, New York is a liberal state. It is not an accident that of all the states Hillary has never lived in, she chose New York as the place to run for public office. But there is one profession in which a capacity to accurately discern voter sentiment is a job requirement. Unlike university professorships, one need hardly add. However talentless they are at everything else, the 100 members of the United States Senate know what sells politically. About the time experts were claiming Giuliani had shot himself in the foot and opera fans were booing him, the United States Senate voted unanimously, in favor of a resolution supporting the withholding of federal funds from the Brooklyn Museum unless the museum canceled the sensation exhibit. Giuliani is anti-dung. Hillary is pro-dung. And I am now taking bets on the New York Senate race. I'm not gambling. I'm making an ironic and whimsical statement about society.
We're number two, November 19, 1999.
We almost won the title. In the New York Post poll of the top 25 most evil people of the millennium, only Hitler edged out our own Bill Clinton by 39 votes. The president's impressive second-place showing handily beat Joseph Stalin, one death is a tragedy but a million is only a statistic, who came in at number three. Our boy also beat Pol Pot and Dr. Joseph Mengele, numbers 4 and 5 respectively. Hillary took a respectable sixth place, ahead of Saddam Hussein, Adolf Eichmann, and Charles Manson. Moreover, when their scores are combined, Bill and Hillary slaughtered Hitler. Together, the power couple, buy one, get one free, got 2,390 votes. That's 726 more than Hitler's paltry 1,664. Of course, Bill and Hillary were severely handicapped by not appearing on the ballot. The president and his lovely wife Hillary were the only entries on the entire most evil list who made it on write-in votes alone. Hillary was the only woman on the list. Finally, a poll I can believe. The poll was conducted over the entire month of October on the New York Post's internet site and received over 19,000 responses. Where were all those Americans who opposed impeachment of the lovable rogue and allegedly despised Linda Tripp? Don't they know how to use the internet? One of the most interesting aspects of the poll is that 16 of the 25 most evil made their mark working for the government. This is not surprising. Political scientist R.J. Rummel estimates in his book, Death by Government, that in the 20th century alone, governments have killed almost 170 million people. As Rummel notes, governments, particularly non-democratic governments, clearly should come with a warning label. This power may be a danger to your life and limb. So keep voting to send more power to Washington. Of all the grisly government bureaucrats on the list, from Vlad the Impaler to Muammar Gaddafi, only two were from America, Bill and Hillary, on write-in votes. The six other American winners were all murderers, Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, Jim Jones, and Timothy McVeigh. Their combined score was lower than the first couple, 2,169 votes for six of America's worst multiple murderers, and 2,390 votes for Mr. and Mrs. Clinton. The only non-government workers on the list were the American mass murderers, plus the Marquis de Sade, number 23, and Jack the Ripper, number 25. Fascists took places number 1, 5, 8, 13, and 17 for a combined total of 3,779 votes. Adolf Hitler, Dr. Joseph Mengele, Adolf Eichmann, Benito Mussolini, and Ivan the Terrible. Excluding the Clintons, communists took numbers 3, 4, and 18 for a combined total of 2,486 votes. Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, and Fidel Castro. This is odd when you consider that the Nazis killed a mere 12 million people, while the Soviet regime slaughtered almost 62 million. Chairman Mao, a revolution is not a dinner party, didn't even make the list, and he murdered about 35 million people in the Great Leap Forward alone. It is believed that Mao may have lost points in the most evil poll for killing so many intellectuals. But this is no time for nitpicking. Back to number two. Bill Clinton scored higher than Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, and John Wayne Gacy together, 1,625 to 1,615. He did better than the combined score of Joseph Stalin and Ivan the Terrible, 1,625 to 1,589. Our number two received almost six times the number of votes as Timothy McVeigh and more than seven times the number of votes as the Marquis de Sade. Clinton got almost 1,000 more votes than Saddam Hussein. Apparently, Saddam's score took a hit when he became Scud missile target practice for some lunatic trying to distract from his personal problems last December. So for now, Clinton will have to settle for being second. This is probably good because, like Avis, being number two will only make him try harder.
Liberals shocked. Impeached felon took Ottoman. February 11, 2001.
I always thought it would be thrilling to be a liberal. Because I'm a cranky conservative, the world simply reinforces my prejudices on a daily basis. But for liberals, everything is always an exciting surprise. They seem to live in a state of perpetual shock. I used to keep a file of New York Times headlines expressing breathless astonishment at the achingly obvious. There would be bold proclamations along the lines of, "Parole officer shocked, child murderer kills again. Experts baffled, crime rates decline while prison populations surge. Mental illness surprisingly high among homeless. New study, rent control reduces available housing." Most recently, liberals have made this exciting new discovery. Bill Clinton is a crook. I hate to sound indifferent to this development, but it wasn't too long ago that liberals were defending this guy on charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. They had no problem with the president killing foreigners to distract from his personal problems. They were willing to overlook credible charges of rape against the sitting president. They didn't mind that the president chatted with congressmen about going to war while Monica was earning her presidential knee pads. Speaking of which, they didn't mind that Clinton introduced the phrase, presidential knee pads, into the national dialogue. But the Clintons take an ottoman when they leave the White House, and the entire liberal establishment goes apoplectic. I guess you find out who your real friends are when you lose the ability to save Roe v. Wade. It's nice that the whole country is finally on the same page about Bill Clinton, but frankly, the vast right-wing conspiracy is getting a little bored with the born-again Clinton haters. Back when Clinton could choose Supreme Court justices, the New York Times sneered about those Yahoo Republicans thinking perjury, obstruction of justice, and numerous other felonies committed by the president constituted impeachable conduct. Now that he's out of office, the Times has finally developed the capacity for outrage. How is it, the Times recently demanded to know, that a departing president and his wife come to put sofas and flatware ahead of the acute sense of propriety that ought to go with high office? Bill Clinton? A lack of propriety? Wait a minute, are we talking about the same Bill Clinton? Chubby fellow, used to be president? The Washington Post has run two editorials denouncing Clinton's most recent felonies. The first, titled Count the Spoons, said the Clintons' decision to create a gift registry for people who wanted to give the first couple farewell gifts demonstrates again the Clintons' defining characteristic. They have no capacity for embarrassment. The editorial continued, "Words like shabby, tawdry, don't begin to do it justice." How about this for a word that does Bill Clinton justice? Impeached. And no thanks to you and your petulant editorials opposing impeachment, Washington Post. In a follow-up editorial titled, "And Count the Couches," the Post called the Clintons' sticky fingers with the White House furniture, ultimately, the Clintons' worst offense. If this is the worst, I'm just wondering where the Post ranks rape. How about that thing with the cigar? How about bombing an aspirin factory in Sudan on the day Monica Lewinsky returned to the grand jury? 2 years ago, The Economist magazine denounced Clinton's impeachment as a partisan witch hunt. Recently, The Economist ran an item titled, "Beyond Shame," informing its readers that with Clinton, the sleaze keeps coming in. Yeah, see, that was the thinking of the partisan witch hunters, which is why we wanted to get him out of office a long time ago. The Economist's groundbreaking news was that a guy who perjured himself repeatedly in front of a federal judge and grand jury, bought off witnesses, bombed innocent foreigners to distract from a sex scandal, and sodomized an intern hours after a Bible-toting stroll from church on Easter Sunday, also did this. On February 5th, the Washington Post revealed that the personal gifts that the Clintons carted off with them included $28,000 worth of furnishings that were given not to the Clintons, but to the National Park Service. At this very moment, you could knock me over with a feather. Former Clinton Kool-Aid drinker Margaret Carlson dedicated her entire Time magazine column to the Clintons' tacky farewell gift registry. "It just smells bad," Carlson was compelled to say. Oral sex from a White House intern was evidently a more ambiguous case. Carlson said the Clintons' friends insisted Hillary simply wouldn't do such a thing, but now, we have proof that they would. Wondering why the Clintons would troll for freebies they can surely afford, Carlson sadly concluded only Freud could sort it out. Not to brag, but that's what the vast right-wing conspiracy has been trying to tell you. But do we get thanks, maybe even a little apology, or at least a polite nod in our direction for having grasped the obvious years before Carlson? Oh no. To the contrary, Carlson takes a shot at the vast right-wing conspiracy, incoherently claiming that since only conservatives complained about the felonies, but now liberals are upset about the ottoman, the Clintons had better take note. The Clintons have long dismissed the criticism of those in the vast right-wing conspiracy whom they don't respect, Carlson says. But how do you dismiss the views of those you do respect, who insist you would never sink so low, until they are silenced by proof of your grasping? I'm not sure I grasp Carlson's point here, but I think she's trying to appeal to the consciences of felons by citing the opinions of idiots. Another loony left columnist, Mary McGrory, spent the 70s demanding President Nixon's impeachment, spent the 80s demanding President Reagan's impeachment, and then when the 90s finally produced an actual presidential impeachment, McGrory was grumpy about it. The Republicans are beyond reason, she screeched a few years ago, and Clinton's impeachment will disgrace them as much as Bill Clinton has disgraced himself. But that was before the Clintons had sunk so low as to take the Ottoman. Recently, McGrory wrote of the Clintons' classy departure, "If the Bushes had called in an exorcist, it would not have been excessive. Gee, we just wanted to impeach him." And all this liberal hysteria was just about the furniture. I haven't even mentioned the pardons. The heretofore unshockable left was truly shocked, shocked about Clinton selling a presidential pardon to fugitive financier Mark Rich. Representative Major Owens, Democrat of New York, member of the Clinton-loving Black Caucus, said of the impeachment of a known felon and probable rapist, "Our posterity will spit upon us for allowing this madness to reach this level. This is a political crucifixion." But this past week, referring to the Mark Rich pardon, Owens said of his constituents, "They think I may have done 1/1,000,000th of what they did, but I'm sitting in jail." His constituents must have been thrilled with that description. I wonder what happens to Owens' constituents when they tamper with just one witness. What happens to them when they get caught telling just a few lies under oath? How many employees are they able to grope and flash before losing their jobs? Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, who had criticized the Clinton impeachment as the result of extreme partisanship and prosecutorial zealotry, sputtered that the Rich pardon was inexcusable, outrageous. It was also made possible by the decision of senators such as Leahy not to remove Clinton from office when they had the chance. Senator Paul Wellstone, Democrat of Minnesota, voted to acquit Clinton, saying anyone with a sense of fairness and proportionality knows that the House overreached when it voted to impeach the felon. But the Rich pardon, Wellstone said, raised all the questions about values and ethics in relation to the Clinton administration. What were those questions again? Clinton lied to the country, lied to his staff, lied to his wife, lied to his party, lied in private, lied in public, and lied under oath. The Senate Democrats voted to keep him in office anyway, but now they profess shock that the man can't be trusted. Barney Frank called Clinton's impeachment an extraordinary triumph of ideology. If it's the Republicans who elevate ideology over reality, how come it's always the Democrats who are being floored by reality? These days, Frank can be found wandering around wailing about a real betrayal by Bill Clinton of all those who had been strongly supportive of him. Senator Joseph Biden, Democrat of Delaware, accused Clinton of being brain dead when he granted the Rich pardon. Yeah, what kind of idiot would have failed to anticipate that the same Democrats who warmly embraced perjury, obstruction of justice, and sexual perversion would draw the line at a presidential pardon? Senator Arlen, not impeachable under Scottish law, Specter, responded indignantly to the pardon, saying, "President Clinton technically could still be impeached, but not under the U.S. Constitution." In his passion for the truth, Specter once again stopped short of reading the Constitution. Representative Christopher "Rape Isn't Impeachable" Shays, Republican of Connecticut, has announced that Clinton's pardon of Rich is sleazy. A rapist sleazy? Who would have thunk? When you're sending half your bank account to the IRS this April, remember, it's because the government thinks geniuses like Chris Shays can spend your money better than you can. During the impeachment proceedings, Washington Post columnist David Broder described the evidence against Clinton on obstruction of justice as very shaky. The evidence included testimony from Clinton's secretary that Clinton coached her to lie in her testimony, Monica Lewinsky's testimony that Clinton told her how to hide the gifts he had given her from Paula Jones' lawyers, and Vernon Jordan's testimony that, at Clinton's behest, he had frantically called corporate magnates to line up a job for Monica, a crucial witness against the president. That, according to Broder, was a shaky case. But now Broder has written that of all the scandals, felonies, lies, and general slime to come out of the Clinton White House, nothing came close to matching Clinton's exercise of the pardon authority. The Rich pardon finally demonstrated Clinton's sheer arrogance of power. These people are literally insane. Most beautifully, the New York Times, the same New York Times that haughtily instructed the Senate on its duty to restrain the zealous House prosecutors from removing Clinton from office, is now demanding that both the House and Senate investigate the Rich pardon. A thorough investigation and reconstruction of the events leading to the pardon are required. It may be appropriate for the Justice Department and the Federal Bureau of Investigation to examine whether any laws were violated. Well, well, well. Kind of a Johnny-come-lately on the need for an investigation, aren't we? In a breaking development, Kenstar already performed an investigation. And surprisingly enough, it turned out laws were broken by the president. Lots of them, too. But for all his diligence and hard work, the New York Times got snippy with Kenstar. So why exactly do we need another investigation now? If the idea is to find out whether Clinton sold presidential pardons, I think I can save the country the trouble of an investigation. The answer is, yes, Virginia, Clinton did sell presidential pardons. In case you missed the Clinton presidency, he also sold the Lincoln bedroom, plots in Arlington Cemetery, government jobs, access to the president, a naval facility in Long Beach, California, and anything else the Park Service couldn't physically nail down. Without embarrassment, the Times lauded Republican Dan Burton for investigating the pardons, reminding its readers that this page has had scant praise for Burton. Yeah, I remember that. This page was really annoyed with Burton for trying to point out that Clinton was a crook. Now the Times is hopping mad at having just discovered that Clinton is a crook. Who's been hiding that from the Times? Either the entire liberal establishment has been guzzling truth serum, or they don't need Clinton to save Roe v. Wade anymore.
Ruger is a girl's best friend. July 1999.
About a year ago, a mugger just waltzed right up to me on a bridge here in Washington, D.C. It was early evening, and I was a stone's throw from my apartment in what is considered a nice neighborhood, as neighborhoods go in Murder Capital, the richly deserved nickname for the nation's capital. I won't belabor my cunning and completely fortuitous escape, except to say that for the few minutes I was standing there waiting to be mugged, I was fuming. I knew he knew I didn't have a gun. It's illegal here in Murder Capital. Not merely illegal, but a felony carrying up to a 5-year prison sentence. Just as I could look at my prospective mugger and see that he was not the kind of fellow who would be a fanatic about property rights, he could see from 50 yards that I was not the type to be casually committing felonies. I wanted a gun, but more than that, I wanted him to think I might possibly have a gun. I wanted him to at least accord me the respect I get from criminals in other cities, where they have to exercise a little creativity, lying in wait, sneaking up from behind, hiding in bushes and dark alleyways. That sort of thing. No, in Washington, they just walk right up to you on a brightly lit street. As an apparently law-abiding citizen, I am ostentatiously defenseless. But let's forget about completely defenseless little me on the bridge for a moment. The framers' primary reason for including the right to bear arms in the Bill of Rights was so that the people could defend their liberties against a tyrannical government, just as they do by virtue of the vastly overrated First Amendment. As Alexander Hamilton observed in Federalist No. 29, if the government were to form an army of any magnitude, that army can never be formidable to the liberties of the people while there is a large body of citizens, little if at all inferior to them in discipline and the use of arms, who stand ready to defend their rights and those of their fellow citizens. Some may be willing to rely on withering editorials in the New York Times to preserve their liberty. I'd prefer a tasteful Sig Sauer. If the courts ever interpreted the Second Amendment the way they interpret the First Amendment, we'd have a right to bear nuclear arms by now. Interestingly, the Supreme Court is constantly having to remind Americans of their First Amendment rights, issuing over 100 decisions in the past half century alone. The court has only ruled on the Second Amendment in a handful of cases ever, the last time in 1939. But still, about half the citizenry deeply, passionately believe that they have a right to bear arms. Give the First Amendment no support from the courts for over half a century, and see if anyone remembers why we're supposed to let Nazis march in Skokie. But the half of the country that intuitively assumes a right to bear arms don't live in my neighborhood. That's why I'm getting exasperated with the constitutional argument. Too few people, girl people in particular, appreciate the central point. Guns are our friends. When it comes to the First Amendment, everyone gets warm patriotic feelings, tearing up over John Stuart Mill's Marketplace of Ideas. They think immediately of our right to engage in political speech, scientific research, and avant-garde art, and to burn politicians in effigy. Or maybe that's just me. Speech on the fringe, like Aryan Nation propaganda or Screw magazine, is understood to be an unpleasant, if inevitable, byproduct of a freedom we cherish. But with the Second Amendment, all we hear about is the downside. It's all Screw magazine, no upside, just school shootings and the apocryphal danger of gun accidents. In 1945, for every million Americans, there were 350,000 firearms and 18 fatal gun accidents. By 1995, the supply of guns had more than doubled to 850,000 per million, but fatal gun accidents had plummeted by two-thirds to only 6 per million. Guns are our friends because in a world without guns, I'm what's known as prey. All females are. Any male, the most sickly 98-pound weakling, could overpower me in a contest of brute force against brute force. For some reason, I'm always asked, wouldn't I prefer a world without guns? No, I prefer a world in which everyone is armed, even the criminals who mean to cause me harm. Then I'd at least have a fighting chance. What the arms control faithful really want is a world without violence, not a world without weapons. These are the ideological descendants of the authors of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which purported to outlaw war. But we can't have a world without violence, because the world is half male and testosterone causes homicide. A world with violence, that is to say with men, but without weapons, is the worst of all possible worlds for women. As the saying goes, God made man and woman. Colonel Colt made them equal. Prey like me use guns against predators about a million times a year. 15 different studies, including studies sponsored by gun control groups, estimate that guns are used to stop a crime several hundred thousand times per year at the low end and several million times at the high end. I especially want criminals to have to worry that I might be armed. In numerous surveys, criminals have confirmed the blindingly obvious point that they are disinclined to attack a victim who might be armed. Countries with those fabulously low crime rates and fabulously fascistic gun control laws, like Canada, the Netherlands, and Britain, have more burglaries of occupied homes than we do in the armed-to-the-teeth United States. Canada's burglary rate of occupied homes is over three times that of the United States. Although murder is lower in Britain, rape, robbery, burglary, and assault are all substantially higher than in the United States. It must be said, the framers were not unaware of the crime prevention qualities of firearms. Standing armies in this country and in France had become nothing more than roving bands of criminals. The Second Amendment was, in part, a response to these earliest cases of police brutality. Incidentally, why is it that the same people who have the least confidence in the police and the military are the most willing to allow only the police and the military to have guns? Democratic darling Thomas Jefferson, for example, wrote, "Laws that forbid the carrying of arms disarm only those who are neither inclined nor determined to commit crimes. Such laws make things worse for the assaulted and better for the assailants. They serve rather to encourage than to prevent homicides, for an unarmed man may be attacked with greater confidence than an armed man." That night in Washington, by the way, I was rescued by a man. I'm all for men. I like to have them around all the time. But they can't be. Sometimes they have to go buy things for us. More pertinently, sometimes they're ex-husbands coming after us with machetes. We live in a world in which men are supposed to freeze when we say no. Our bodily integrity is sacrosanct. We are autonomous beings. I am woman, hear me roar. But we're not allowed to defend ourselves from a physical attack with the only effective means possible. Just stand waiting on the bridge and hope for a nice man to come along.
I'd burn my neighbor's house down. September 15, 2000.
I did everything I could, and it's not my fault. As a legal resident of the noble 4th District of Connecticut, once represented by glamorous, brilliant, smart-aleck Claire Booth Luce, and currently represented by a hand-wringing panty waste, I tried to take out the panty waste. For those of you who don't have Irish Alzheimer's, we forget everything but our grudges, Representative Chris Shays was one of only five Republicans to vote against the impeachment of a lying, felonious, contemptible president. One of only two Republicans to go on a whirlwind, grandstanding campaign against the impeachment of the lying, felonious, contemptible president. And the only Republican called on by Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, on the day of the vote to argue against the impeachment of a lying, felonious, contemptible president. I didn't run in the primary against Shays because, as a writer, I'd have to give up my livelihood to do so. If I were a dentist, I could continue to remove molars while campaigning against Shays. As a writer, I'd have to abandon my career the moment I announce. I'll give up a month or two for a grudge match, but not 6, 7, or 8. Moreover, an excellent Connecticut Republican, Jim Campbell, did step to the plate to primary the panty waste, offering nutmeggers the enticing prospect of voting for someone who not only would represent Republicans, but would also represent the district rather than representing the New York Times. No one had ever heard of Campbell. He emerged out of nowhere, and the principleless Connecticut Republican Party establishment was dead set against him. If Joseph Stalin called himself a Republican and was an incumbent politician in Connecticut, he'd have the full backing of the state party apparatchiks. Still, Campbell took about 40% of the vote from Shays. Though I wasn't willing to sacrifice my profession and my life for the absolute minimum 6 months it would have required to run in a primary, I was willing to forsake my profession and my life for about 6 weeks simply to achieve the greater glory of causing Shays to lose. My idea was that I'd run a total sham, media-intensive, third-party Jesse Ventura campaign for 1 month before the election and hope for enough votes to cause the official Democrat to win. I just needed to find a third party that would have me. Since I hate the government and the libertarians hate the government, I figured that's my party. Except the thing is, the local libertarians' opposition to government is totally focused on one small aspect of the government, the drug laws. Until going